Now, it's Gabe time. Gabe Kuhn.
Gabe Kuhn was one of the great little trivial nuggets in all football bios. His grandfather was the inventor of the Easy Bake Oven.
Like a boss, the best lineman on the radio. Well, the only lineman on the radio. It's Gabe time.
Game time. We're ready.
The Gabe Kuhn Show, 92.9 FM, ESPN.
Happy Friday out there. June 7, 2024 is the date. Welcome in to the Gabe Kuhn Show. I am your host. You hear me right now? Gabe Kuhn, former Memphis Tiger offensive lineman on X at G_Kuhn71. I'm alongside the executive producer of the Gabe Kuhn Show. As always, that's Connor Dunning on X at CDunning929. Connor, how you doing?
What's up, man?
You holding up?
Holding up.
You talked out yet?
Not yet.
It's been a whole week.
Oh, I can give
it a whole week.
Not too. It's just
rolling.
Two extra hours. Not too bad.
And I hear from what I understand, you have a lot of notes on the on game one of the NBA Finals.
Lots of notes.
Yeah.
Lots of notes.
Two full pages.
One full page. One full page of notes.
Front
well,
back?
Notes. It's just my notes app.
Oh, okay.
I don't know. How do you quantify? I have to scroll a couple times. Does that count?
They don't have pages on notes. Yeah. I get it. I understand. I use it to my advantage all the time. But we have 3 hours of talk on the way, courtesy of 92.9 FM, ESPN, and yours truly. Celtics are up 1-0, and they handled business last night. Now, the Mavs tried to make a little bit of a run coming out into the second half, but then the Celtics took off. Yet again, behind great performances from Kristaps Porzingis, Jaylen Brown, really the whole team. Watching them on the defensive end, to me, last night, was really the highlight of that game. And I thought they were decent on the offensive end as well. But to hold down that Mavs offense to 89 points, to hold Kyrie to 6-for-19 shooting, 0-for-5 from 3 with what he's been able to do in these playoffs, that was absolutely phenomenal. Also, we do have some coaching carousel in the NBA news. Danny Hurley has gone to L.A., and they have met. His family has met with Lakers brass. We'll see what happens here. But I do want to make a point about college athletics versus professional and how this whole thing's working out. I think you'd be deceiving yourself if you ignored the signs of what we have seen in the past year of a lot of college coaches making their jump to the professional levels. Now, I know there's a lot of people that are, you know, college purists that want to ignore these things, but I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to do that because I think that there is a point to be made. As far as guests are concerned, on the show today, David Cobb at 5 o'clock from CBS Sports covering college football and college basketball. We'll have Eric Hasseltine at 6 o'clock, Grizzlies play-by-play voice, and that'll be fun. That'll be absolutely fun. We'll talk about the NBA Finals, what the Grizzlies are going to do, although I don't know if Eric has a whole bunch of thoughts on that right now. Talking to him off the air, it's more like, you know, what do you think about these rumors? I don't think about them. Like, that's sort of the idea.
He's in off-season mode.
That's
he's like, talk to me after the draft.
Yeah, he's heavy into being a dad, doing baseball and basketball camps. That's where he's at right now, but we will catch up with him at about 6 o'clock. We'll hop into the Blitz around 6:30. Where, did you see this? The NCAA has passed the guideline allowing schools to put corporate logos on their football fields. So obviously at Memphis, likely FedEx or Simmons Bank. I think there's already a Simmons Bank logo because the stadium is sponsored by them. But, you know, FedEx could be on the way. And then also, what else could be on the way? Patches on the jerseys. It is becoming increasingly clear to me, with revenue sharing on the way, Connor, that they are doing everything they can to tap into every revenue stream they possibly can, because there's a lot more money and expenses being put toward college athletics with revenue sharing on the way. And then I'll ask you, because you won't be here for the final hour to talk about this, but Zach Randolph was on Podcast P with Paul George, and he talked about, you know, Marcus Gasol and Mike Conley, and, you know, how annoyed he was at first when he got traded to Memphis, but how he just latched onto it. You saw this clip, I'm sure.
I did see it. And I don't think he was annoyed getting traded to the city of Memphis because of the team that they had. It didn't sound like he was worried about the success that they could have. I think that he was just like, me personally, in the city, I know too many people for it to be a good spot for me. And then he talked about how, you know, he embraced the city, we embraced them, and then how the friendships blossom with all of those guys and how much love he has. And I guess I didn't realize he was officially working for the team. That's something that came out during the podcast that was fun. My biggest takeaway, though, future Memphis Grizzly Paul George.
Yeah, I guess so. Let's get him on a veteran minimum. Like, that's all we're looking at.
Hey, he loves
and
GG.
Then, another thing I took from it, and Mike Conley in a front office somewhere as a coach, I could absolutely see
that. Mike would be, if he wants to, he would be incredible as a coach.
I think that, I wonder though, like his personality, it's not that like hop in your behind personality. And maybe he could
assistant.
Unlock that. Maybe he could unlock that as if he's an NBA head coach at some point. But I think like a front office role, like Tayshaun Prince is similar like that, where his personality is just, it jives with a lot of front office roles. I think Mike Conley would be good in that type of role as well. But we'll talk about that. That was something that Zach Randolph brought up. He knows that he'll be in basketball for a long time, Mike Conley.
Yeah, I think that's one thing that I think we discussed it during the Timberwolves series, the last series, that the presence that he has on a basketball court and in a locker room is invaluable. And I really do think if Mike wanted to be a head coach, whether it's high school, college, pros, he would be excellent at it.
And also worth mentioning, and I've been mentioning it all week, if you're a Memphis football fan, Antoine Hill Jr., number 12th ranked quarterback in the entire country in 2025, number one ranked quarterback in Georgia. He started his visit today, and did you see his suite that he's in at the Peabody?
It
looks pretty nice. It looks better than what he was dealing with at Florida, and we know Florida and Memphis are really sort of the two people in this battle for him. To be the quarterback, and, you know, we'll talk about it. I still think that Memphis is in a great, great spot. And it looks like he'll be announcing in July where he's going to commit to. July 13th, I believe, is the date. So it's right around the corner, but he's taking his visit. Might be his last visit before he makes that commitment. And I think there's a lot of – it's just strange to me, though, Connor. And we've been talking about it since the FedEx, NIL, the influx of money came in, about $7 million, $7.5 million a year. To be able to talk about Memphis football recruiting in the same breath and in the same tone as we have talked about Memphis basketball recruiting for years and years and years, it's different. It just shows a changing of the guard, a changing in the understanding of what we need to expect from that football program. It's fun. Usually you found guys with, you know, in between the cracks. Paxton Lynch, for example, like just going to, it's a great quarterback run we've been on. Paxton Lynch, two-star recruit, ran the wishbone in high school. Right, Riley Ferguson went to Tennessee, had to go to JUCO because he didn't work out at Tennessee, ends up coming back, you get him out of the JUCO ranks. Seth Hennigan, three-star recruit. Now you have gone through this great run of quarterbacks, and on the back end, you're looking at a four-star, top 15 quarterback in the entire country. It's just different. It's completely different. And this is one of the best runs I've ever seen in the group of five on quarterbacks in a long, long time. I can't think of one off the top of my head. But we'll talk to David Cobb about that, see if he can remember one. But let's go ahead and get into Celtics versus Mavs. Celtics handled business. They're up 1-0, and it went exactly how I sort of expected the game one to go. They came out energized. They looked like they had it about them. Now, they ended up starting Al Horford. And Al Horford, I can't say enough about the guy. I mean, 38 years of age, 16th year in the league, playing perimeter defense out there on Luka where he's blocking three-point opportunities. It's absolutely nuts. But Kristaps Porzingis, when he got into the game, absolute firecracker. 20 points in 20 minutes. He came back, tied the whole thing together. And offensively, what we're seeing from the Celtics is exactly what I thought we'd see. They have so much depth offensively with their top six options. Their leading scorer, Jaylen Brown, who was phenomenal last night, like really good, especially on the defensive end. I think he had finished with two blocks as well. But he had 22 points. That's it. That's it. They had six players in double figures. They all shot relatively well from the field outside of Jason Tatum, who was 6-for-16. But Drew Holiday added some. Derek White added some. Al Horford added some. Kristaps, of course, was phenomenal. Sam Hauser had a good game. They're just so deep on the offensive end, it's going to be hell for the Mavs to defend them over a seven-game series. That is the first thing you noticed when watching that game last night.
Yeah, and you want to talk about Jason Tatum. A lot of people are trying to say he had a bad game last night, and I just fully disagree with that sentiment because, you know, the stats are coming out.
Wasn't great, but...
Well, he wasn't great scoring the ball, but he set up his teammates over and over and over again in a very real way. It was pretty obvious to me that last night, the Dallas Mavericks, their strategy with the Boston Celtics was, we are going to collapse on Jason Tatum, and we are going to make the rest of the Boston Celtics beat us. We are not going to lose game one with Jason Tatum going off. So they tried to eliminate Jason Tatum as much as they could, but he did a really good job at facilitating the basketball, finding those guys in the corner, finding his open teammates. Here's a stat for you last night. Tatum passed out of 61.1% of his drives last night. He only passed out of 25.2% of his drives this season.
Yep.
So because the Dallas Mavericks, there was always two or three guys in the paint. They were collapsing on him every single time he was driving. And he actually set up his team. He had a team-high 18 drives, a game-high 14 potential assists. His teammates just went 5 for 19 on them, so he was creating mismatches constantly, and he was setting guys up like KP and Derek White. He was getting them open, especially in the corners. I think one of the reasons you saw those turnovers go up is the second half, the Dallas Mavericks switched up what they were doing just a little bit. They weren't collapsing on him as much, and I think that Jason Tatum was expecting those bodies to come, and he was trying to kick it out, and he was just throwing it into traffic, and that's why you saw that turnover number go up, especially in the second half. But overall, I thought Jason Tatum had a really good game. He was setting his teammates up on the offensive end. He just wasn't scoring the basketball at a high level, but defensively, he was fantastic, and on the rebounds, he was fantastic. So Jason Tatum, I understand he wasn't putting the ball in the hoop, but he still had a really effective game last night, and he was kind of running the offense for the Boston Celtics. So he deserves more credit than he's getting. But to your point, Jaylen Brown was the MVP of the game.
Yes, and he's the early leader for finals MVP.
Well, and
no
Drew Holiday, too. Holy crap.
I'll say this, too. Like, as much as people want to give credit to Derek White and Drew Holiday and Jaylen Brown and everything else, your point about Jason Tatum is well taken, because in the end of the day, the amount of attention you have to pay to him just allows everybody else to be wide open. Al Horford, how many times do you see him just wide open, in stride, keep the ball up around his head and be able to take a wide open three from the perimeter? Jason Tatum, the attention that gets paid to him opens up the floor for everyone else. And maybe he doesn't have a good-looking offensive night. Maybe he's inefficient against 6 for 16, 3 for 7 from 3, the 6 turnovers. But the attention that's paid to him frees up everything for them on the offensive end. Now, the defensive side of the ball, I will say, a lot of people will go this direction. And I think there is there's some nuance here we have to work through. The Mavs did play dumb. I didn't think they played very well last night on the offensive end. They didn't share the ball very well. Their leader in assists was Kyrie Irving with 2. Luka Doncic had 1 freaking assist. They only had 9 the entire game. But this does show also the depth the Celtics have on the defensive end. Mavs had 9 assists. Celtics had 9 freaking blocks, right? The ability the Celtics have to just avoid the type of things that the Timberwolves ran into with the Mavs, where you're switching a rim-protecting big out there on the perimeter and he cannot, Rudy Gobert, defend Luka out there. I watched them try to chase an Al Horford switch, and Al Horford is step-for-step right there with Luka, not buying fakes, blocking out, closing out, and blocking a three-point shot from Luka Doncic. There's not a lot of bigs that can do that on the perimeter, and it's just so hard to exploit them defensively. And even when you go and blitz Luka Doncic, their ability to recover is second to none in the NBA right now. It's so hard to exploit that defense, and that was probably the main thing that held. I mean, they held them to 89 points, and we know how good the Mavs have been offensively with Kyrie and Luka. And Kyrie, yeah, he stunk last night, but I think that has to do a lot with Drew Holiday and how damn good he was on that end. Kyrie Irving, of course, was 6 for 19 from the field, 0 for 5 from 3. He had the 3 turnovers, which is actually high compared to where he has been in these playoffs. But Drew Holiday, as the main defender, was, in my opinion, the main source, the main reason that Kyrie had such a bad night.
Yeah, I agree. Drew Holiday and Derek White did a really good job. And last night, one of the reasons I think the Boston Celtics were able to throw off the Mavericks so much is that they were picking him up as soon as they touched the basketball. It was basically a full court press on Luka the entire time. So they were disrupting the flow of the game. They were trying to speed up Luka a little bit. They weren't able to get into their offensive sets until about 15 seconds to go in the shot clock when they would finally get in position. Drew Holiday was an absolute menace last night with Kyrie Irving and Luka Doncic. Basically, in the first half, it felt like his assignment was, hey, you're going to go after Kyrie, you're going to take him out of this game. And in the second half, he was on Luka much more, but he did a tremendous job. They changed the pace of play for the Mavericks in a way where they couldn't really recover. And you brought it up. I do think we need to talk about the impact of Kristaps Porzingis and Al Horford. Their drop coverage in the pick and roll is absolutely fantastic. And the switchability on the perimeter of the Boston Celtics makes it damn near impossible for the Mavericks to get those lobs that they want to do. Because, at one point in the game, Daniel Gafford could not be in there. They could not be in there at all. And one thing that I think that Joe Mazzulla deserves a lot of credit for is how he used Jason Tatum. Jason Tatum last night spent 5 minutes minutes and 26 seconds total on the defensive end on Derek Lively and Daniel Gafford. They were putting him on Derek Lively and Daniel Gafford, so whenever they would try to do that pick and roll, every time they would switch, all of a sudden Luka and Kyrie was looking at Jason Tatum right in front of them whenever they would switch now, and it would force Gafford or Lively to make a decision, and they just couldn't. It was incredible what the Boston Celtics were able to do last night. Their switchability is so effective, and any time Kyrie or Luka looked like they were about to get around one of those defenders, they were forcing them inside and make them go into the paint, and you would have either Kristaps Porzingis or Al Horford standing right there ready for them.
And then also, you can have Derek White,
yes,
Jason Tatum, Jaylen Brown, they'll recover and go help at the rim if they need to.
They would help when they needed to, but they didn't overhelp, which was great because they were able to defend them one-on-one most of the time, and that's how they were able to eliminate the corner shots. I think they were only 1-for-3 from the corner threes last night, and basically in the Thunder series, the reason they were able to get past them, and in the Minnesota Timberwolves season, the reason they were able to get past them is those corner threes, and that lob threat was always present with the Dallas Mavericks. Last night, the Celtics completely eliminated those two aspects of their offensive game, and it is why you saw the dominance on the defensive end from the Boston Celtics.
And you saw Al Horford getting into those switches, and I already mentioned he blocked a three-point shot from Luka Doncic, but you can tell he's not worried about Luka blowing past him at all.
No.
And I know that Luka's not, his first step's not unbelievable by any stretch of the imagination, but he certainly can get around you. But he's not worried about that. He's worried about the three-point ball going up like Rudy Gobert got exposed in that Timberwolves series, right? So he's just playing there on the perimeter. If Luka wants to put up a three, he's going to be right there in his face. If Luka wants to get around him, here comes Jason Tatum, Kristaps, Derek White, all these guys to come try to help him at the rim. And it's just, it's well done on the defensive end. They're a well-oiled machine.
Well, to that point as well, in games 2 through 5 in the Timberwolves series, Rudy Gobert only had 2 blocks. In game 1 last night, Kristaps Porzingis had 3 blocks. And then you add Jaylen Brown's 3 blocks and the ability of Derek White and Drew Holiday at the rim. The rim protection from the Boston Celtics is just one of the best in the NBA. Once again, they were the second best defense in the NBA this year, the number one offense, and you saw it come to fruition last night. They just controlled the game. The only moment that the Mavericks looked like they had a shot was at the end of the first half. Early in the second half, you got to give Joe Mazzulla credit again. He called timeout, and basically after that timeout, the Celtics got it back together. They kind of fell into that ISO basketball. We're going to jack up threes. I know the Celtics offense primarily runs through the three-point shot, but it's when they're playing team basketball and they're driving and kicking like we talked about with Jason Tatum. That is how they are effective on the offensive end. It's when they're relying on ISO basketball, that step-back three. That's when they can have these lulls, and that's why, it felt like the crowd for a moment was like, uh-oh, is Luka going to be able to bring him back? But then they adjusted, they got back into their offense, and they were able to get rolling again.
And we need to admit this up front right now. I mentioned already Jaylen Brown is the leader to be the finals MVP off of one game. He was a maniac last night.
He was incredible.
He was a maniac. And on the offensive end, he was very efficient. But on the defensive end, 6 freaking stocks. 3 steals, 3 blocks.
Wow.
And he was bringing the fight directly to the Mavs, front line. Like the dunk over top of just everybody.
Like 4 Mavericks.
I mean, he was...
The best defender was the rim.
He was maniacal last night. He literally was not going to be denied. And I thought it was one of the most impressive Jaylen Brown performances I've ever seen, even in only a 22-point performance.
It was interesting. I wonder if we're going to see the Mavericks just go full small ball, because that's the only time they had any success in game 1 was when Derek Lively was playing at their center position. When Maxi Kleba was in there and when Gafford were in there, they were getting blown off the court. The only time they had any success was when Derek Lively was running that 5. But, with the Boston Celtics and how they run their defense, you just assume that they're going to adjust to that eventually. So it's just...
Because, honestly, Al Horford
it's
going to
be hard for the Mavericks to win this
series. Al Horford in there at 5 is a form of small ball.
Right.
Right?
Right. And Luka was 1-for-8. 1-for-8 with Al Horford as his primary defender.
I know. And obviously, during the year, I saw this stat yesterday. I think Al Horford was 3rd or 4th in opponent field goal percentage when he's guarding Luka during the year. So he's always done really well against Luka.
I mean, dude, you and I talked about a few weeks ago. You asked me this question. Is Al Horford a Hall of Famer? I still think it's a solid maybe right now. If they get a ring this year, he might get in. Because his defensive performance
I think he'll be stamped, yes.
is his impact. You just
And you,
it doesn't necessarily show up on the paper. It's when you're watching these games, the way he affects an offense, the way he completely took away the lob threat of the Dallas Mavericks, he is invaluable when he's out there.
And we had this discussion as well. Like, some games in these playoffs, he has looked old. Like,
sure.
I completely understand that. But when KP was out, they won 9 of 10 games. Like, there's a difference when Kristaps Porzingis is out there hitting from 35 feet. Like, I understand that. There's nothing you can do to guard that. He's a better offensive player, and he's probably a little bit better of a rim protector. Just look at the three blocks last night. There's some games he looks old, but most of the time you cannot tell Al Horford's a 38-year-old who's in his 16th year in the NBA. He still plays with this edge about him, this toughness that he always has played with, even dating back to Florida. It's impressive as hell. I still think I think that eventually, even if he doesn't win this championship, he can make his way in just based on college and pros. But if he gets this championship, I think we can go ahead and stamp it. I really do believe that. And I put out a poll not too long ago.
Did you really?
Most people thought yes, that Al Horford's a Hall of Famer.
Extremely likable player too.
Yes,
easy to root for.
100%.
And one of the best finesses of all time, taking that contract from the Sixers because they were literally scared of him because of how he defended Joel Embiid, and then immediately when he got a chance, he went back home to Boston. That's amazing.
Now, winners of game one go on to win 70% of the time. And if it's the home team who wins game one, 79% of the time. I think that is a little bit, for the Celtics, an interesting stat, because I don't think they've fared well in game twos. They haven't. They're 1-2 in game twos in these playoffs. So game twos usually when they have, let go of the rope a little bit. We'll see if they do that in game two, or if they can tie it all together and they look good again. And Kristaps gives them what he did in game one. But game two is going to be an interesting watch.
Well, and the Mavericks are 1-3 in game one. So we've seen the Mavericks drop game one in a couple series now, and then they make adjustments for game two and they get themselves back into it. My question to you is though, it just felt like watching the game last night, the Mavericks are going to have to make major adjustments. It just feels like what the Celtics did is sustainable through the series, and you have to imagine that they'll play better on the offensive end. Because really, the Celtics in the first quarter, their offense was amazing. It was clicking. The rest of the game, it wasn't great. So if they can put it together offensively the rest of the series, I just think it's going to be tough for the Mavericks. I still think they might be able to get a game or two because the factor of Luka and Kyrie, they might go off, but when I was talking through Jeffrey about it, the only two games the Celtics have lost in the playoffs this year included two historic shooting performances from those teams. I think the Mavericks might have one of those games in them, but do they have four of those
but
games?
But also
in them?
On the other side, it's like I think those two games you're talking about, the Celtics were miserable from the 3-point line, too.
That's
they took
thing.
A historic shooting night from the 3-point line for both of those teams, and then just in general from the field. And it also took the Celtics just settling for threes and being stupid, which it's there. Like going into the second half and some of the shots that they were settling for from three to start that second half, I turned to you when we were at Laughlin Yard last night. I said, there's the Celtics I know and love.
In the second quarter, when the Mavericks were up, or the Celtics were up however many points they were, you and I looked at everybody and said, the Mavericks got to run in.
There's going to be a run.
They're going to get it within single digits, just because you understand that Luka's going to take over for a moment. The Derek Lively small ball thing worked at the end of the first half, early second half. But then Boston adjusted, and they started playing team ball again on the offensive end, and all of a sudden they were up by a 20.
Haven't we talked about this, though? The Celtics sometimes need to be reminded that they can lose ball games.
Sure.
To really turn it on and flip the switch. The Pacers series, games 1, 3, and 4, they had to be reminded they could lose those ball games. They come back, and they win in clutch time. Last night, going into the second half, the Mavs cut it to 8, and then they're like, okay, yeah, we can lose this ball game if we screw around. Let's put the foot on the gas. Let's get going. And then they did. They did. It's a different Celtics team in the fact that in the past, when they allow these things to happen, they allow other teams to go on the run, they'll continue to allow them to go on the run. This year, it has been, especially in the playoffs, in these playoff scenarios, they let these teams go on runs, they give up a big lead, or they're down, but then they turn it on and they get going.
Well,
and they realize,
hey,
let's make something
happen. He called timeout 3 minutes into the third quarter. He's been pretty good throughout the playoffs, and I think you've been beating this drum all week. Kyrie and Luka. Kyrie, he's going to have a better game than 6 from 19, 0 for 5
yes.
from 3. You know he's going to have a better game. Luka, he gave you 30. It's just the rest of the Dallas Mavericks. Do you trust them against the rest of the Boston Celtics? PJ Washington is going to have to turn back the clock and turn into Ray Allen again, because the dirty little secret of the last series was PJ Washington did not shoot well from three against the Timberwolves. And that trend has continued so far into the NBA Finals. If he is not shooting 35%+ from three, I just don't know if the Mavericks are going to have a chance, because they're not going to be able to throw any punches at the Celtics other than Luka and Kyrie, which, again, that can win you a game or two, I think. I just have doubts about it winning you four.
And I also have this fear, too, for the Mavs. You're not going to, like, this is a series where Derrick Jones Jr. on the offensive, he's not a good offensive player in general. He's not going to be able to give you much on the offensive end. You just have to hope that his defensive prowess sort of carries the day.
Well, again, PJ Washington and Derrick Jones Jr., the reason they thrive so much throughout these playoffs is they lived and died by those corner threes. The Celtics only allowed three of them last night. Three total shot attempts from the corners. If that trend continues, it's just going to be really hard for the Mavericks to run their offense the way that they want to.
Yep. Now, on ESPN, broadcast, whatever, I can deal with it. I thought it was really cool. Doris Burke made history. First female announced team for a men's professional sport in their finals, in the NBA finals, or in, you know, it could be World Series, it could be whatever. But that was really cool. That was historical. The ESPN broadcast in general, though, halftime show, truly abysmal. Like, as bad as I've seen ever. They did probably a grand total of 3 minutes worth of breakdowns. That was it. That was terrible, Connor.
So
they didn't do anything.
I didn't.
It was all sold spots. It was all strictly commercials that they sold.
I've got a theory about this, because I didn't notice it in the moment, because we were at Laughlin and we were watching the game with a few people. So you're not really paying attention to halftime as much. But I saw clips on Twitter afterwards. To me, I think they had a production issue, because the camera angle was odd.
And they kept going.
And they weren't changing the camera view. I wonder if somehow they just lost their cameras and they had the audible, and that's why they were doing all these ads and they weren't really breaking. Because JJ Redick had like a 3 minute stretch where he talked about it, but then again they went to commercial.
Let's assume it was a 15 minute halftime or so.
It felt mismatched.
15 or 20 minute halftime or so. There was maybe 4 minutes worth of content.
There's just no way that was that the programming schedule was that way. It can't be, because it's embarrassing if so.
I hope you're right.
I hope I'm right.
I hope that it was a production issue, but I don't know. Being that it's ESPN and we've already had our complaints, I sort of...
Well, considering the conversation we had yesterday, it's just another reason where it's like, oh no, I don't know if I want ESPN to have
I love how their response to all the complaints about, you know, their Knicks coverage and that Pacers series and how it was so pro Knicks. Their response to that is bring Josh Hart on. Yeah, let's throw him in there. I thought he was good, though.
He was good.
I thought Josh was fine.
He was good.
But that's their response to all the Knicks coverage that they had in the second round of the Eastern Conference Finals, or the Eastern Conference Playoffs.
Are the only people mad about that Pacers fans, though, if we're being honest about it?
No, sure, but I just find it funny. After all of the
salt in the wound,
after all of the complaining about their Knicks coverage, they're like, "Yeah, let's bring on Josh Hart." That seems like the solid answer to this whole thing. But let's go ahead and grab our first break of the day. And when we come back, we're going to stick to the NBA, but we're going to go to the coaching realm as Danny Hurley has visited the Lakers. He's in LA today. He brought his family along, brought his wife along, and it looks like it's trending to where he potentially will take this job. We'll talk about that next, and also, I want to talk about this. Is it an indictment on college athletics that our two revenue sports, one in football, Jim Harbaugh, one in basketball, and Danny Hurley, could be potentially off to the pros after winning a national championship? We'll talk about that next. But Dan Hurley, who has won the last two national championships in college basketball, has met and is continuing to meet with Jeannie Buss and Rob Pelinka today. So we'll see how this all works out. I think the fit would be very interesting. He's definitely a culture builder. He's a good roster builder, probably the best that does it in college basketball today, especially the last 2 years after winning national championship with losing three of his starters to the pros a year ago and then getting better. But, you know, the fit in the NBA, I think, is something that we have to pay attention to. He's a guy who will definitely try to command respect in a locker room, but you do have LeBron James. You want to create a partnership with him. You can't piss him off. I do think that if you were to win and Danny Hurley takes this job,
If you were to win, all of those guys, those vets, will fall into line as long as you're putting out the right X's and O's and you're winning ball games. I do think that there is a interesting, you know, wrinkle here. When you look at Danny Hurley and his wife, they're both Jersey kids. So they're very used to the East Coast. That's where they're at right now. I wonder if, you know, he could hold out and potentially try to see if the Knicks open up or the 76ers. That would definitely fit his geographic footprint a little bit more. But if you're getting paid $10 million per year to coach the Los Angeles Lakers, there are very few people in the history of coaching that have turned that down.
You could have two houses.
Yes, you could. You could. I'm just saying, you know, the L.A. footprint, not necessarily where he's used to being.
Right.
Where he's used to being. Now, what I really want to talk about, because we've already talked about the fit and everything else, is the potential we're looking at where we have national title winners in the two revenue sports in college athletics, in football and basketball, hightailing it for the pros. We know about Jim Harbaugh heading to the Chargers, and I think that's a distinctly different situation. Jim Harbaugh was in the midst of two NCAA investigations, one for sign stealing and one for COVID recruiting. Maybe he always wanted to get back to the NFL after his time with the 49ers. So I think that's distinctly different. But it is crazy how similar over the past few years that Danny Hurley and Jim Harbaugh and their situations are. Because let's be honest, Danny Hurley and Jim Harbaugh, in their first few years with Michigan and UConn, respectively, they had their struggles. They had people on their ass in those particular markets. Danny Hurley wasn't getting into NCAA tournaments. Jim Harbaugh couldn't get over Ohio State, continually lost to them. Couldn't get Michigan into the national relevancy of being in a national title contention. So they started off with a lot of struggles. But the last 2 to 3 years, let's go through it. Michigan finished the last 3 years 40-3 with a national title. And then when you look at what Danny Hurley's done the last 2 years, or last two seasons in particular, two national titles, 68-11. So they had to overcome a lot at the beginning of their careers at their particular spots to get to where they were in winning national titles. So I think they're very similar in that regard. Also, I think stylistically as coaches, they're kind of similar. They're both known for their unique coaching style, combative behavior. Now, in press conferences, they will give you some, you know, colorful answers. They both beat Alabama in the national semifinals last season to get to a national title. So there's a lot of similarities between the two. And it makes me question right now, if Hurley does indeed take this job with the Lakers, which it almost feels like it's headed that direction with the money and everything that's on the table, is this an indictment on college athletics? Is it an indictment on college athletics in the current state of affairs? Two national championship coaches who have reached the pinnacle of what you want to achieve at college, who seemingly, if they were to stay at their respective spot, would continue to achieve those things. I think you'd be insane to think otherwise. I think you'd be insane to not at least try to make this somewhat of an indictment on college athletics. And when you look at college athletics in general, what do you look at? Revenue sharing, right, is on the way. You have GMs, general managers, and you have players making more than coaches. Connor, what does that sound like to you? GMs, revenue sharing, and players making more than coaches. What does that sound like to you?
Pros.
It sounds like professional. But the difference is in college, you have transfers, you have an uncertain future, you don't know where realignment's going to take you. You don't know what the superpowers are going to be going into the future. Why deal with all that and not be at the peak of your profession in professional basketball or professional football? Why would you deal with all these professional things and not be coaching professionals? Because here's the biggest thing that you do need to understand about the way these guys have to operate at the college level. They don't know what their roster is going to look like year to year. You know what you do know when you get into a professional spot? You know what your roster is going to look like. There's free agency, but you have guys on contracts that are bound by contracts that get to stay on your roster. You know what you're going to have year to year. Know what you don't have in college athletics? An understanding of what your roster is going to look like, because transfers can consistently get in the portal, leave. You can develop them, get in the portal, leave. And they have there's no bounds to how many times they can do it. They can get in the portal and leave. There's nothing. They can play for a division rival. They can play for a conference rival. And you have no say over it.
So I think if you are one that is trying to insulate college athletics through this entire process, and again, we have no guarantee that Danny Hurley is going to take this job. But if you're trying to insulate college athletics, I think you're wrong in this moment. I think it is much, and it has been in the past. There has been certain coaches that have a personality that fits with the pros better than their college days, even though they were successful in college. But I think with all of these different things that are happening, with revenue sharing, with players making more than coaches, with the ease of movement of college athletics, and how uncertain year to year is, it is a much more attractive option to hightail it to the pros. You have an understanding of what your roster is going to look like. You have professionals you're dealing with, and you have contracts that you're dealing with. So I think it is somewhat of an indictment on college athletics. That doesn't mean everybody's made out to be a professional head coach. That's not what I'm saying. But if you're a high-level coach in college and you get these opportunities, it's going to be hard to say no going forward.
Absolutely, and that's why I've seen a few people try to make the case, well, you know, a former NFL head coach is going back to the NFL, and, well, a coach is considering the Lakers position, so this isn't a reflection on the state of college sports. Okay, I can buy those two things. Like, I can hear the Lakers are just going to back up a truck full of money for Hurley, and that's the main reason he would go. I can hear that Harbaugh always wanted to get back to the NFL, and that's the reason he's going to go. But then, what about Nick Saban retiring?
Yes.
What about Coach K retiring? What about Chip Kelly demoting himself and going to be an offensive coordinator? What about all these other things that are happening right now, too? Because if you just want to use these examples and say, well, this is about money, okay, well, what about all these other coaches? What about Jay Wright retiring?
What about Jeff Hafley done coaching at BC, heading to the Packers to be a DC?
Yep.
I mean, the writing's there. It is hard to be a college coach. There are certain people that are built for it. I look at college football, for example, and I always bring up Dan Lanning and Kenny Dillingham and Marcus Freeman as guys who can really, you know, go, and Mike Norvell as well. They can deal with these things, and they can move forward, and they can adapt, and they can, you know, continue to have success. But the sustained success you have at college is just harder and harder to find. Because of the way things are moving and shaking right now. And I think there's a lot of coaches that may be in their late 40s, early 50s, that think that coaching in the professional ranks is just a better option for them at this moment. Now, it used to be where you would sort of talk about, you know, recruiting and everything at the college level. You know, maybe they want more time with their family. You're not getting more time with your family at that level, but you have more of an understanding of what you're dealing with day to day. You don't have this uncertain future. You know what to expect year to year, day to day, when you get into those professional locker rooms and everything else. So I just think you have to view this as somewhat of an indictment on college athletics. You have to realize the issues that all of these great coaches are dealing with at that level. There's a reason Nick Saban didn't want to adapt again. He's 72 years old. He doesn't want to move into the future where we're going to have to share revenue. And some people may view that as hating, but it's just a different day and age, and it's hard to adapt time after time after time. It's much easier to hightail it for $10 million a year to go coach the Los Angeles Lakers than it is to try to rebuild your roster year after year when you have set these national championship expectations at UConn.
Right. It's just the highest coaches leaving, either through retirement or going to the pros, it's not about money. It is about the state of college athletics right now. And if you want to put your head in the sand and ignore it, you can do that. But you're ignoring a huge issue. It's been the wild, wild west for the last few years in college athletics. Something needs to be done to calm it down. Because when the coaches are telling you there's an issue, it means there's an issue.
Yes. Now, moving on from that, and we'll see if we get, before the show ends, if we get an announcement that Danny Hurley will ultimately take that job. I want to get, go ahead.
I have an update on that.
Okay,
Jeff Goodman is reporting that Hurley went into the meeting today with the Los Angeles Lakers with an open mind, and the meeting is now over, and he's flying back home to mull the decision over the weekend.
Yeah, and something I did want to bring up before we move on and get to some of the NBA draft rumors, which are kind of ridiculous. I don't know, like
the Ron Holland thing
seems like a smokescreen. We'll get that in a second. But J.J. Redick, did you hear him on the Golics podcast?
No.
He was talking about the Laker rumors, and they asked him, like, are you involved in that coaching search? And Shams was reporting he was the front runner earlier this week. And we had Trevor Lane on to talk about J.J. Redick.
Oh, wait, is this from, like, 2 days ago?
Yes, but yeah. He was with the Golics,
And he was talking about Shams, and he goes through the whole thing, and he says, you know, I have so much time invested in the NBA Finals and trying to get this right. I have 19 different podcasts it feels like I'm doing. I'm doing it with LeBron. I have my own podcast, Old Man in the Three. My time is so caught up with that that I'm not worried about the Lakers opening. But then he gets to the end of it, Connor, and he basically says, and on the Shams front, I'll approach this, I'll address this after the season ends. So it sounds like there's some beef between Shams and J.J. Redick on the way this thing was reported.
Probably so. Probably so. I don't think it's a secret that a lot of people have issues with Shams and the way he operates.
Yeah, 100%.
It's a problem.
And Woj clearly sat down for a while and just waited for this thing to play out, and Shams just wanted to jump.
You know that when that Shams tweet went out, wherever Woj was, he sat back, started kicking his feet. And he was so happy because he knew that he was bringing the hammer of Hurley the next day.
Yes.
It still might work. You know, Hurley might still end up going back to UConn. And if that happens,
JJ,
I do think that JJ probably gets the job. But to get that scoop the day after, he's like, JJ Redick looking like it's going to be the head coach.
And Woj just makes a ton more sense.
It makes way more sense.
And we have way more source stories. We have Danny Hurley saying that he's going to go in with an open mind. We're able to track planes to show that Danny Hurley's going to L.A. and meeting with people, and they're actually approaching this with an open mind. Where a Sham story, it was just less of that. Oh, well, he's the front runner. There was not much reporting on that. It was just throwing it out there as fact when it wasn't necessarily the fact. If they can get Danny Hurley, they're taking Danny Hurley 100 times out of 100 times.
Yes.
Over J.J. Redick.
That's the correct decision.
I think it's very clear. Now, NBA draft rumors. I heard you talking about this a little bit earlier on Jeffrey and Company. But Ron Holland, this is sort of the news of the day if you've been following along. But Ron Holland, who is the number two overall recruit in the 2023 class, it looks like, according to Jonathan Givony of ESPN, that he could potentially drop out of the lottery. That seems to me to be a strange, strange news drop. And to me, Connor, that seems like a big smokescreen, because I think there's a lot of teams in the top 14 that would be willing to take a flyer on freaking Ron Holland.
Listen, we have talked about the Grizzlies and their number 9 pick, but I'm telling you right now, if Klingon's not on the board and Ron Holland's there at 9 and the Grizzlies pass on him, I'm not going to be happy about it. You know, he's
but
the type of guy.
I will say the fit with the Grizzlies and the timeline's a little weird because you have G.G. Jackson. You have him at home. You have Ron Holland at home.
Right. I guess so. But Ron Holland is a really talented basketball player.
He's number one on the big board for John Hollinger in a lot of different draft prospects.
I just don't see him sliding out of the lottery whatsoever. It feels like a smokescreen to me. I talked about it with Jeffrey. I do think, you know, the Charlotte Hornets have expressed interest in Ron Holland.
Yeah.
And if you had a little core of LaMelo, Brandon Miller, Holland,
develop
Mark Williams,
Ron Holland.
That's pretty good.
You could get it rolling.
So
you could make something happen.
I'm going to present this to you. This is one of the trades of the days that we did. Santi and 9 for 6. Maybe sprinkle in Z if they take him, please.
I think that would be
advantageous.
I'd be okay with that.
Then you
take Klingon, and obviously Klingon at 6 is the thing you have to put there in the preface trade. Klingon has to be the pick at 6. Yeah, I'm fine with that.
Yeah.
I'd be completely okay with
10 out of 10 times.
Yeah, that would make a whole lot of sense for the Grizzlies, who have been rumored to move up to 3 and to 6. That would make sense for me. But the other rumor is, if the Grizzlies stay at 9, from Jonathan Givony, Edie is definitely a guy they're interested in.
That doesn't surprise me.
I am curious, though, and I know I heard you talking about this throughout the week. I'm just curious about what actually he'll look like in an NBA system. And the biggest thing will consistently be with me, foot speed. How do you deal with drop coverage? How do you play the pick and roll on the defense?
He's good at it.
Luckily, he's 7'4", and he's long, and that helps in that. But his foot speed is not up to where I would want it to be for him to be a surefire pick at number 9.
It's better than people give him credit for.
Yeah.
He's good at drop coverage and pick and roll.
And his athletic numbers were better than Donovan Klingon's at the NBA Combine.
You and I have discussed this. If you're going to have, if your minus is going to be on the defensive end, the Grizzlies are a pretty good fit for you.
Yeah.
Because they have players around you that they can help you out on the defensive end. Jaren Jackson Jr. would be his help defense on a pick and roll. I think I can live with that. Because, again, I think the Grizzlies are looking for somebody that checks 3 boxes. They can set screens, they can rebound, and rim protection. And
yes,
all 3 of those things he does well.
And one thing that Edie will do, I think,
play?
He's a team guy. He's a team guy. You're not going to use him how he got used in the Big Ten and in college. You're not going to throw it into the blender and just have him go work around the rim.
I want to see more so his passing ability out of the post, because that's what made Steven Adams such a natural fit with this team. He could pass out of the post, and he wasn't a black hole like Jonas Valanciunas was. I get the sense, though, that Zach Edey could fill that role and actually do it at a high level.
So 2 years ago, he was horrific at it, and it was a huge issue for Purdue. Last year, one of the reasons they were so effective was he learned how to pass out of the post. And
he holds the ball high, and he's got good visibility.
He never brings the ball down, which is massive if you're a 7-footer. You can't bring that ball down because it allows people just to swipe that thing away. But he keeps the ball high. Another thing is, though, he's not going to get doubles thrown at him in the NBA. They're just not going to be able to throw two bodies at him. So he's not going to have to be passing out of a double team as much as he did in college. I think he's okay at it. I wouldn't call him a plus passer. He's okay at it, though. He has shown signs of maybe being able to do it. Again, I would be more comfortable if Edie's the guy that they want, find a way to trade back a few spots, get him at a better value. But at the end of the day, if they take him at 9, it's going to take me a couple hours to talk myself
into
it.
Yes, of course. Like, I am of the opinion, I have gotten a lot more used to the thought of Zach Edey if they were to stick at 9, if they took him. I wouldn't be like as opposed as I was before the draft process started.
Now, the caveat to that is, though,
I would
they
be a
still
lot more
have some work to do in the offseason.
Yes, they'd have to go get
through trade
go
or through
find
free agency.
Go find vets.
You still need somebody to be in there that can help him out, because I don't feel totally comfortable with him being the center heading into next year. But if he's one of them and part of their rotation, sure. You know, I think I'd be okay with that. Now, real quick, we are getting reports now about what the offer might possibly be from the Los Angeles Lakers.
Okay, let's
to Hurley.
See.
Are you? You're sitting down, so
yes.
You're ready for this.
$10 million a year is what I heard first.
This is from Anthony Irwin, who is part of Odyssey Sports. Shout out. Ballpark of 8 years, $100 million. You cannot turn that down.
8 years.
You cannot. That is generational
that
wealth.
That goes directly to our thought that we've had all week about this is not a LeBron James, Anthony Davis hire. This is an organizational hire for when they're done with LeBron James and Anthony Davis and they move off into the sunset. I do think he'd fit really well as a culture builder for a young team. And I think if you give him 8 years, you're very clearly that's your plan with him.
Is 8 years $100 million? That's a crazy number.
Even more than $100 million.
It's the 8 years.
It's the 8 years.
Yeah, no, the $100 mil, I get that.
It's
the 8 years.
But that falls into line with what I think this hire would be made for.
Security.
Yes, it's security for your future.
Yep.
Not necessarily right now, and I think you could do fine with right now, with LeBron James and Anthony Davis. But you're trying to secure somebody for the next wave of superstars, next wave of young players you get.
I floated this by you, too, yesterday. Let's just say, if you're the Lakers, you know that LeBron wants J.J. Redick. But you also know that LeBron wants Bronny in the NBA. Could there have been a scenario where they went to LeBron and said, hey, man, you're going to get one or the other. We're not going to hire JJ, but we're going to hire Hurley, and we'll draft Bronny at 55.
I don't even care to comment on that right now. I'm going to be honest with you right now. Because that's still ridiculous.
That is 55's fine. Yeah, if he gets taken to 55,
but it looks like he cracked the first round.
If he goes first round, everybody's drunk.
But it looks like he could.
Can't happen.
Right?
No way.
We'll see. We'll see what happens. But let's go ahead and transition into hour number two. Coming up next on the other side is my guy, David Cobb, joins every single Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. But he will join next right here on the Gabe Kuhn Show, 92.9 FM ESPN.
I don't feel totally comfortable with him being the center heading into next year. But if he's one of them and part of their rotation, sure. You know, I think I'd be okay with that. Now, real quick, we are getting reports now about what the offer might possibly be from the Los Angeles Lakers to Hurley. You're sitting down, so
yes.
You're ready for this.
$10 million a year is what I heard first.
This is from Anthony Irwin, who is part of Odyssey Sports. Shout out. Ballpark of 8 years, $100 million. You cannot turn that down.
8 years.
You cannot. That is generational wealth.
And that goes directly to our thought that we've had all week about this is not a LeBron James, Anthony Davis hire. This is an organizational hire for when they're done with LeBron James and Anthony Davis and they move off into the sunset. I do think he'd fit really well as a culture builder for a young team. And I think if you give him 8 years, you're very clearly that's your plan with him.
Is 8 years $100 million? That's a crazy number.
even more than $100 million.
It's the 8 years.
It's the 8 years.
Yeah, no, the $100 million. I get that. It's the eight years.
But that falls into line with what I think this hire would be made for.
Security.
Yes, it's security for your future.
Yep.
Not necessarily right now, and I think you could do fine with right now with LeBron James and Anthony Davis. But you're trying to secure somebody for the next wave of superstars, next wave of young players you get.
I floated this by you too yesterday. Let's just say, if you're the Lakers, you know that LeBron wants J.J. Redick. But you also know that LeBron wants Bronny in the NBA. Could there have been a scenario where they went to LeBron and said, hey, man, you're going to get one or the other. We're not going to hire J.J., but we're going to hire Hurley, and we'll draft Bronny at 55.
I don't even care to comment on that right now. I'm going to be honest with you right now. Because that's still ridiculous.
I don't know, 55's fine. Yeah. If he gets taken at 55,
but it looks like he cracked the first round.
If he goes first round, everybody's drunk.
But it looks like he could.
Can't happen.
Right?
No way.
We'll see. We'll see what happens. But let's go ahead and transition into hour number two. Coming up next on the other side is my guy, David Cobb, joins every single Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. But he will join next right here on the Gabe Kuhn Show, 92.9 FM ESPN.